Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Hope you are warm and safe tonight. We're sending out positive vibes to our listeners and friends in Texas and Oklahoma and the other parts of the country that have had to endure various weather-related calamities this week, some natural, some man-made. There's a magazine I subscribe to. It's called True West. It always is filled with these great stories about the Old West and cowboys and outlaws and lawmen and derring do and legends and lore. And in the front of a recent edition, they had a quote from one of the greatest Texans of all, Willie Nelson. And he says, "I'm from Texas, and one of the reasons I like Texas is because there's no one in control." That's a very Texas-y kind of a thing to say, as I'm sure Texans would agree. You know, and at times, I'm sure a lot of people, including most who live in Texas, would accept that, the logic of that. But I would think that after what's happened this past week, I'm guessing some Texans kind of wish someone was in control after all. I mean, what a mess. I do have a Texas-centric topic to cover tonight. Saw a book review last year in the New York Times about this new history of the Texas Rangers, and I love that kind of stuff. So I tucked the idea away as an idea for the program. We're going to get the author on at some point, and we finally got him lined up to appear here on the show, tell us about the Rangers and their history, the good, the bad, and the ugly details. And I'll tell you, this book really packs a punch, but I didn't know at the time that we targeted the author to have him on the same week that calamity struck Texas in the days leading up to this program. So I'm just letting you know that wasn't on purpose, and I say it because a lot of what's revealed in this book is pretty tough. I mean, Texas was a wild and lawless place when Americans started moving in by the thousands back in the 1830s. So a lot of the history from that era is not pretty. And we're going to hear that story, warts and all, the heroism, the battles, the Comanches and Apaches, the Alamo War, tussles with mobsters and arch criminals and banditos, and civil rights issues. It's a story as big as Texas itself. It's called Cult of Glory by Doug Swanson, who spent many years as a reporter and editor at the Dallas Morning News. He currently teaches writing at the University of Pittsburgh, and wow, did he do some digging for this book. Doug joins me in just a couple of minutes, and we'll jump right into it. In the second half tonight, Thomas Ferrario returns to Coast. He was here last year with George Norrie to talk about the work of the late Ted Phillips, who was a pioneer in the study of what's called trace cases. He's a colleague of the late Dr. J. Allen Hynek. I had the privilege of knowing Ted and interviewing here on this show a couple of times, and he gave what might have been his only radio interview about a secret he was pursuing called the Moonshaft Project. It's a strange object that was buried in a cave in a mountainous region in Europe, and Thomas Ferrario has picked up the mantle from Ted in the study of a truly weird region known as the Marley Woods, as well as this Moonshaft Project. Marley Woods, if you don't recognize the name, very similar to Skinwalker Ranch in terms of a range of what we'll call unusual phenomena reported there. Really looking forward to getting some updates from Thomas, especially on that moonshaft mystery, and that's in the second half tonight. Webmaster Lex Lonehood and I have pulled together a few items and oddities culled from various news sources around the world. We call it Knapp's News. You can find it on the Coast to Coast AM website. Among the stories there tonight, one that I might ask my first guest about, it's a True West article, asking a question about who might have been the inspiration for the most famous ranger of them all, the Lone Ranger, that is. The article has a strong candidate to answer that question, assuming there was any model at all. Also, a pretty comprehensive story about Göbekli Tepe. I think that's been mentioned multiple times on the program. This is this truly unusual temple built in Turkey that continues to baffle historians and investigators and defy the timelines we have for human history. Also, so many eyes are on the skies this month with the successful landing of Perseverance on Mars. Really exciting time, the search for evidence of past life on the red planet. We have one story about the competition between the U.S. and China for turf and control on Mars. Also, This month is the 50th anniversary of Apollo 14, which sent three American astronauts to the moon. Alan Shepard and Edgar Mitchell walked on the surface of the moon. They were the fifth and sixth humans to walk there, and they returned safely. And then on the way back, Dr. Mitchell conducted his own secret psychic experiment from space. I was honored to know Dr. Mitchell during his lifetime. I interviewed him about that moon mission and his psychic experiment and thought you might want to see some of that. So we put that in Naps News. And while you're on the website, check out how to become a Coast Insider. If you subscribe for a year, the cost is 15 cents a day, gives you access to a huge archive of programs and interviews, including the Art Bell Vault. You can listen anytime you want, as often as you want. It's a great deal. And so is a subscription to Beyond Belief. That's George Norrie's television program, which covers many of the same compelling topics and guests that we explore here on the radio. With that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog and the cat and the chicken and the armadillo. Put on a pot of Joe. Slide your bod into those winter flannel jammies and some thick socks and slippers. Plop yourself down in a comfy spot. Turn down the lights and turn up the radio, because we're about ready to rumble. In a moment, Cult of Glory, the bold and brutal history of the Texas Rangers with Doug Swanson. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Doug Swanson is the author of five novels and two nonfiction books, including one about a Las Vegas legend named Benny Binion. Doug has been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. He taught journalism at Stanford, and as I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, is now teaching writing at the University of Pittsburgh. This new book, Cult of Glory, is a stunner, filled with stories about gunfights and shootouts with Comanches and tracking down bad hombres, but also some very dark chapters about the real-life characters who called themselves Texas Rangers. Doug, welcome to the program.
Hey, George, it's a great honor to be with you again. Thanks for having me.
You know, I just made the connection tonight that I had read your book about Benny Binion, and that this is your other work. And, you know, I don't remember if I told you, but after Binion died, I had covered him for years. After he died, I filed, I think was the first FOIA request for his FBI records. And it took 6 years to get them, but it was, what an incredible array of information. I read that there's a TV series in the work. If that happens, you'll have to come back and talk about Benny Binion again.
Oh, I would love to. And yeah, it's under in development right now by a really legitimate production group out in Los Angeles. So, you know, we'll see what happens. I'm optimistic. And, you know, he's such a great character.
He was, oh, my God.
Wouldn't that be a terrific series?
Well, the rest of the family's pretty good characters, too, though, you know.
That's true. There's a bunch of them, yeah.
So this book, I mean, wow. You know, I did not purposely get you on the show in a week after disaster struck Texas. I was walloped by a storm and then unfolded in terms of failed responses, failed preparations for it, death and suffering, all that stuff. But in a sense, the independent streak that you describe in this book about the Texas Rangers, the attitudes that Texans don't really want to follow rules that govern the rest of us, I think you call it Texas exceptionalism. I don't think Texans would dispute that attitude as being prevalent, and it is an evidence in your book, and I think it probably contributed to what happened this week.
Oh, I think so. I mean, that's what most of the evidence is showing this at this point. It's because Texas, for various reasons, did not want federal intrusion and did not want to be part of the federal grid, so they decided we're going to do it on our own, and you see what resulted, and that's really the... For better or worse, that's the mindset traditionally in Texas. Very independent, obviously, and a sense that they're going to take care of themselves, you know, come hell or high water or ice and snow.
And again, pointing out, you are not a snooty East Coast elite guy who's here to attack Texas. I mean, you live there, you work there, you know it like at the back of your hand. You know, you covered it and were editor and reporter. You walk the walk and talk the talk, but what is the origin of the idea for the book? Did you cover the Rangers in their current incarnation as a journalist?
I did. I was at the Dallas Morning News for almost 35 years. I lived in Texas for more than 40 years. I went to the University of Texas at Austin. I married a Texas girl. I mean, my Texas roots go very deep, and I had lots of encounters with the Rangers as a journalist, and they were all good. I mean, I didn't come into this with an axe to grind. I didn't come into this thinking, man, I'm going to get the Rangers now. I thought that this it was just time to take a look at this really famous agency, one of the most famous law enforcement agencies in the world, They're coming up on their 200th anniversary very soon, and I thought it was a really good time to take a really broad look at the Rangers and examine their entire history, not just the glorious parts. I mean, certainly looking at that, but examining some of the dark underside to this, taking a really hard examination of some of these incidents that are unsavory or less than flattering, but are really fascinating and are part of the, as you alluded to in your introduction, part of the entire story of Texas, which is glorious and wonderful and also terribly violent and bloody. And it, you know, just covers the entire spectrum.
I'd like to start with sort of what it is now, because you make the point in the book that very few Texans have ever seen a Ranger. I mean, describe the agency today, how many of them there are and what they do.
Yeah, the agency today is actually pretty small. There are about 160 Rangers right now. You know, and in a state of almost 30 million people, it's true. Most Texans have never seen a Ranger. Unless you're in law enforcement or you're a criminal, you probably haven't met a Ranger. They engage in any number of activities now, including intelligence along the border. They investigate official corruption. They investigate jail deaths. But their main function is what it's often been over the years. They help small towns, small town police departments, small county sheriff's departments. If you're a sheriff out in a county of only a few thousand people way out in West Texas and you have a homicide, you may not have a homicide detective. And so you might bring in a Texas Ranger to investigate that for you. So they bring their investigative abilities to bear. And it's a modern police force now with standards and training and, a good reputation for the most part. It's not anything like it was. Initially, it was not a professional organization. It did not have standards. It did not have training. If you had a horse and a gun and you could shoot pretty well and ride pretty well and you knew the right people, you could become a ranger.
Yeah, I'm thinking the only law enforcement agency in the world that would carry the same kind of weight as when you come into a room and announce, hey, I'm a Texas Ranger, I'm here to investigate something, would be like Scotland Yard. But these guys, the story that you tell, for most of their history, they were not really lawmen. They were not an official agency. They've got this image, my image, of course, like many people, would be from Lonesome Dove, prior to reading your book, solid, hard men who did what was necessary. Gus and Woodrow, Colin McRae, and righting wrongs and settling scores, their own code of honor. That is not the picture you paint here, at least not for some of them.
Yeah, we have to say up front, look, there were a lot of courageous, honest, upright Rangers over the past 200 years. I mean, we have to give them their due. They did many brave things, and they tamed the frontier that was Texas. I mean, Texas was a wild and violent place when the first white Americans started showing up in the 1820s. Texas would not be Texas without the Rangers. We have to say that. But, there is this dark side. They behaved over the years in really terrible ways. I mean, they burned peasant villages. They slaughtered innocent people. They committed war crimes. They were as feared along the Mexican border as the KKK was in the Deep South. It goes on and on and on. And so while we acknowledge the courageous, glorious side, I think we also have to take a really hard look at the underside, too.
You paint the origins starting 1823. So what was happening in Texas around that time? You do paint some really vivid pictures of just how tough huge, giant stretches of Texas were back then and the challenges that faced the early settlers.
Yeah, Texas was a part of Mexico then. I mean, it was a Mexican state. And Mexico, to its everlasting regret, decided they needed to open it up for settlement. So they invited in small groups of white Americans. And the first group was led by Stephen F. Austin, known as the father of Texas. And Stephen F. Austin, in his first journey into Texas in the early 1820s, encountered the Caracoa Indians, which a lot of people never heard of. And we've all heard of the Comanches and the Apaches and the Sioux and all that. But the Caracoa were this small coastal tribe in Texas, but they were really fierce. They were big, muscular. They were covered in tattoos. They slathered themselves with alligator grease to keep off the mosquitoes. And they were said to be cannibals. That was the legend about them, that if you were caught by the cannibals, by the Karankawa, you were going to be eaten. Now, that was exaggerated, but that's what white people thought of them. And when Stephen F. Austin encountered them, it was a peaceful meeting. They had a little bit of conversation in Spanish and then went their separate ways. But Austin decided on the spot that the Karankawa had to be exterminated. He wrote that in his journal. These people must be exterminated. And so that's what the first rangers in 1823 really were set out to do, was control the Karankawa. There were 10 of them, and they were sitting downriver near the coast to look for a Karankawa and build a small fort. They never found any, and they ran out of food and ammunition and soon went back to their day jobs. But that was the first rendition of the Texas Rangers.
And Stephen F. Austin, he comes, he looks at Texas, he sees rich, fertile, abundant land that could really be the basis for a great empire, agriculture or whatever, except for this pesky Indian problem, and he just decided they had got to go.
Yeah, and it wasn't just them. I mean, there were lots of other Indians in Texas at the time, like the Cherokee and others who were soon sent fleeing or were killed. And Texas at the time, these people coming in from Tennessee and Louisiana and Mississippi and elsewhere, they were brave pioneers. There's no doubt about that. I mean, they were coming into a strange land, not knowing what they were going to face. But at the same time, many of them were looking to expand slavery. They'd run out of room in Mississippi and Louisiana, and Texas, especially East Texas and parts of South Texas, were very good for cotton farming. And to farm cotton profitably, they believed they needed slaves. So this was an expansion of the Southern slave empire. And so they needed this land. They needed lots of land. And the Native Americans were on it. So they needed to either run them out of the state or kill them, which they did.
And, of course, there were inevitable conflicts. I guess the tribe you're talking about, they would capture horses, wild mustangs, and tame them. Then they see, gosh, there's horses in these corrals. It's a lot easier just to take them. So the Indians get a reputation as every Indian is a thief. They got to go.
Yeah, and that's the way they were regarded then. History has taken different viewpoints on this. It's certainly not like the old Cowboys and Indians movies. I mean, who's the evil person in this? Well, we can't really say it. It was there was a lot of evil on both sides. There was a lot of brutality on both sides. And it was, it was a fight for land. It was a fight for survival, literally a fight for survival. And it went on for many, many years. And we can talk about the Comanches as we go on here. Was the big fight.
This first settlers come in. Of course, there is crime. There are dangers. There is trouble. There are no courts. There's no police out there. So the first variation of the Rangers is formed. That's almost like a posse of vigilantes.
Yeah, because as you say, it's not like you arrested someone and you took him in and put him in jail. There weren't any jails in a lot of these places. There weren't any judges. There weren't any courts. So oftentimes the Rangers and others acted as, judge, jury, and executioner. That's the way it had to go. Unfortunately, that system extended for many, many, many years, and it got out of control, especially down along the Mexican border.
That tribe that you mentioned, the Karankawa, they were wiped out. They're gone.
They're gone. They were gone within probably. For all effects, within a dozen years, maybe a few hung on for a while, but yeah, they were eventually exterminated. I mean, they had been there for thousands of years. They had dealt with the French and the Spanish and the pirates, but when Texas was settled by white Americans, yeah, they were wiped out.
It's surprising, I guess, looking back, that the Spanish and the French both came through Texas and thought, not much here. They didn't see any potential for it. They just moved along.
Yeah, it was too wild for them, too dangerous. there were too many Indians. They tried, and the Spanish would set up some missions, and the missions would exist for a while, and then they would get wiped out in Indian raids. And that's one of the reasons the Mexican government invited Americans into Texas. They thought that there would be a buffer against the Indians. They thought that this would help preserve Texas.
That didn't work out so well. We're talking with Doug Swanson. Cult of Glory is the book about the Texas Rangers. Going to jump into some details here in a moment. Marty Robbins there, Big Iron, singing about an Arizona Ranger. But in my mind, my preteen mind, when I first heard that song, he's talking about Texas Rangers. And that sort of helped cement in my young mind what the Texas Rangers were all about, you know, and then movies and TV. I mean, John Wayne, Clint Eastwood, Roy Rogers, Gene Autry, they all played Texas Rangers at one time or another. Chuck Norris in the TV series. And we have this idea that's sort of been carefully cultivated over the several decades of what the Texas Rangers were all about. Some of that image has been sort of brushed over a little bit. And Doug Swanson's going to tell us how it was done right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Doug, in Cult of Glory, you mentioned a couple places in the book how the image of the Texas Rangers has sort of been massaged and manicured. It didn't just spring up on its own. It's, you know, we've been conditioned by TV and movies and books and things of that sort. I think about the Rangers and one of my favorite movies, the greatest Western of all time, The Searchers. There's John Wayne riding with Ward Bond and a posse of like sort of volunteers who are Rangers. And John Wayne's character is nuanced. He's complicated. He's not a guy necessarily wearing a white hat all the time.
No, and that's a great movie. I mean, that's one of the classic Westerns, right? Most of the movies about the Rangers, and there have been hundreds of movies and TV shows, present them as very one-dimensional figures, you know, the upright cowboy out to serve justice and do good. And, you know, of course, it's more complicated than that. Now, The Searchers itself is based on the legend of Cynthia Ann Parker, who was kidnapped as a young girl by the Comanches. And the Rangers did eventually rescue Cynthia Ann Parker, and the captain, Ranger captain, who led that mission, Sol Ross, was later elected governor of Texas, based on, in part, his heroism in this raid. Well, as you know, as it turns out, the story is much more complicated than that. Cynthia Ann Parker did not want to be rescued. She had married a Comanche chief at that point and had bore children. And she was not happy when she was thrust back in the white man's world. And the raid itself was made out to be this heroic bit of combat. Well, actually, it was just a massacre of mostly women and children in this Comanche village. So that's a really good example of how the facts are really messy and not all that flattering, but they were built into this legend.
Yeah, you describe a lot of different confrontations between Rangers who in those days, as I said, were just like a posse. Hey, go out and get some Indians. And they would go out and do that job. But there had some really dramatic battles and epics, searches. And, you know, they wiped out that one tribe that we talked about before, but then they ran into the Comanches. And that was a different ballgame.
That certainly was. And the Comanches had their origins up in Wyoming and Colorado, and they were, a nothing little tribe. And then they found the horse. You know, the Spanish had brought the horses to North America, and some escaped, some were stolen. And the Comanches were probably the greatest horsemen in North America. There was just this melding of man and beast. There was nobody who could ride a horse like the Comanches. And that transformed that tribe, much in the same way the Industrial Revolution transformed other parts of the world. I mean, they became the most powerful Indian tribe and feared Indian tribe in on the continent. And there was this territory called Comancheria, which was their territory, and it ranged from Colorado down through Oklahoma, Texas, all the way into Mexico and to the Gulf Coast. And they prevailed for probably about 100 years, and it's because they were so good on horses. They could, you know, a Comanche warrior could bend down under a horse's neck and fire off 30 arrows in a minute. Now, meanwhile, the Rangers are firing single-shot weapons and having to reload them, which could take anywhere from 30 to 60 seconds. And, you know, while you're reloading, you're full of arrows. And what turned the tide was Samuel Colt's five-shot revolver. Colt had developed this revolver and then gone broke, but the Texas Rangers got their hands on some of them. And under the command of Captain Jack Hayes, who was one of the most decorated, revered Rangers of all time, they began using these five-shot revolvers, and that revolutionized warfare against the Comanches. And finally, they had a way of the Rangers had a way of fighting back, and that, you know, that turned the tide. It wasn't the Rangers alone who defeated the Comanches. The U.S. Army certainly had a role, but it was that that Colt revolver that did it.
Is it Captain Hayes who goes to Washington after he had done some heroic stuff? He goes to Washington, is meets the president. He's highly celebrated. And then I guess one of the Rangers, I don't know if it's him from your book, but meets with Colt and tells him the specifications. Here's what we need. And Colt was almost out of business or something, and this turned around?
Yeah, it was Sam Walker, another Ranger.
Oh, Walker.
Captain. And there was a weapon then developed called the Walker Colt. And yeah, he helped Colt refined the weapon. He also helped Colt get some government contracts, which, you know, helped put him back in business. And, you know, eventually Colt develops the so-called gun that that won the West. And, you know, the Rangers were a big part of that by bringing it into action and showing how it could be used. You know, the first Colt revolvers were not all that good. They sometimes blew up in your hand. They were difficult to reload. They were very heavy. But with the Rangers' help and others, you know, Colt developed the weapon more and more, and it became crucial to the conquest of the West.
You describe it as the Long War. Is the I guess that's the one with the Comanches, but it's, you know, these settlers, you know, the cattlemen, the stockmen see the potential of Texas, big ranches where you could raise all kinds of cattle, but the Comanches would not go quietly, and there were some terrific battles that you describe in this book back and forth of terrible slaughters by the Rangers and then Comanches fighting back and doing some pretty bad stuff themselves to settlers.
Yeah, there was horror and terror on both sides. There was a line through Texas from north to south called the Bleeding Frontier. And if you went past that line, you were probably dead. You went into Comanche territory. And the Comanches were desperate because these settlers were killing the buffalo and were taking their land. So the Comanches were, as I said earlier, they were fighting a war for survival. So were the white settlers. And there was brutality and torture and terror on both sides. You know, the Comanches were feared more than probably any other Indian tribe because they were so fierce and so good at battle. And, you know, they used torture. They would kidnap women, especially, and turn them into slaves. They came often by the full moon. So there was a saying in Texas called the Comanche moon. When it was a full moon in the summer in parts of Texas, it was a time of great fear because that's when the Comanches attacked.
You tell some stories. I mean, I've always heard these legends sort of about giving Indians blankets that were infected with smallpox. That something sort of like that happened.
Oh, sure. That's that was one of the ways they did away with the Karankawa and others, was infect them with smallpox. I mean, that was a tried and true method. Now we have to. I get criticized sometimes for people say I want to apply modern standards to past events. And you have to be careful about that. I mean, I guess it's called presentism in some circles. We have to be really careful about, I think, being too judgmental because we have to realize it was a terrible, violent place out on the frontier. And violent means were called for. We have to acknowledge that. At the same time, we can't whitewash what happened. We can't look away from this brutality. We can't sugarcoat it and, you know, dress it up as they did in Western movies as this morality play. It was very tough and hard, and boy, I wouldn't want to live like that. But lots of people did.
You describe a couple of really interesting characters, one of them named Alligator Davis. Tell us about him.
Well, he got his he was one of the original Rangers, one of the early Rangers, and he got his reputation for allegedly wrestling an alligator to death. I mean, these were some colorful characters. There was three-legged Willie, so-called because he had a one leg that was congenitally deformed and bent back, so he had a peg leg, and he's buried in the Texas State Cemetery now, where the heroes of Texas are buried. There are, you know, just a tremendous number of great characters. There was Leander McNelly, who was accorded a reputation as one of the greatest Texas Rangers of all time. There was a movie about him back in 2001 called Texas Rangers, where he is depicted as this ranger who went out and killed a wild band of outlaws, controlled them. And what McNelly was actually doing was he was working for the King Ranch, the big spread down in South Texas. And, you know, McNelly was beloved by his men. He was very brave. But what they were doing, what the Texas Rangers were doing then, is they were going into Mexico and retrieving stolen cattle, stolen from the King Ranch, and the King Ranch paid them very handsomely for it. And McNelly, at the same time, this was in the late 1870s, was trying to start a war with Mexico, another war with Mexico. You know, the first one had been in the 1840s. He wanted to start another one. He tried very hard to do that because the King Ranch and other big landowners down in South Texas wanted a war. They wanted to go into Mexico and seize more territory. And they also wanted to be able to sell cattle and cotton to the U.S. Army if they were fighting in Mexico.
They also wanted to expand slavery.
That's right.
You know, the Texas Rangers were, you know, at the same time that some of them were fighting Indians and pushing them out, they wanted the Mexicans out as well, because I think probably most of us forget that Mexico disallowed slavery. It was illegal there, and a lot of slaves were escaping across the border, and so Rangers would go after them.
That's right. The Underground Railroad in Texas ran south. You didn't generally try to make your way up to Canada if you were a slave, a runaway slave in Texas. You went to Mexico, and that was very dangerous. The Comanches might get you. The Apaches might get you. The slave hunters might get you. The Rangers might get you. And there was one mission by a ranger named James Callahan in the 1850s, and I think historical evidence is very strong that he and the Rangers went across the river hunting runaway slaves. That was their goal. They didn't catch any. They were defeated in battle by a coalition of Mexicans and Seminole Indians, and they had to burn down a Mexican village to escape. It turned into an international incident, and they came back across the river in failure. But here's a good example of how the Ranger image is burnished. After Callahan died, one of his fellow Rangers decided to reinvigorate his reputation, and they started pumping out all sorts of legends of James Callahan and his bravery and all that. And now Callahan County in Texas is named for him.
You tell some, this guy, this character appears throughout the book. He pops up in different adventures because he had such a long and colorful career. Ben McCulloch, who came to Texas, he followed Davy Crockett to Texas, but he got smallpox and wasn't at the Alamo, right?
Yeah, measles.
Measles.
It was a family friend, and McCulloch was going to come to Texas and join up with Davy Crockett at the Alamo, but he got the measles and so missed out being killed at the Alamo. He became one of the more famous Rangers, even though one of his arms had been damaged in a duel. He served in the Mexican War and was a valuable scout in the Mexican War for the U.S. Army, saved a lot of lives. And the Rangers, many of them went down into Mexico in the 1840s and joined the Army and stayed together sort of as Rangers and performed a great service there as scouts, as guerrilla fighters. They saved lives, as I said. But at the same time, they committed so many atrocities. They would just go into villages and wipe out the entire village. They would kill prisoners. They were known as Los Diablos Tejanos in Mexico, the Texas Devils. They committed so many atrocities that finally General Zachary Taylor, who was in charge of the U.S. forces in Mexico, said, these guys are very valuable, but we can't take it anymore. Get them out of here. they got to be gone. Ulysses S. Grant, who was a lieutenant in the Mexican War, was appalled by the Texans. Again, he said they were very valuable scouts and helpers and fighters, but they were so murderous that he wrote to his future wife that he couldn't believe what he was seeing.
There's an incident that you describe called the Council House Fight, and I'm seeing it in my head as you write about it. What an incredible outburst of violence that was, and it had huge consequences later on. Can you describe it for us in a nutshell?
Yeah, that was in San Antonio in the 1840s, and the Comanches had been invited in to talk peace. And the Comanches at this time were pretty weak from famine and disease, or weekend, I guess. And so they came into this so-called council house, which was a little government building in San Antonio. And they were supposed to bring in all their hostages at the time, women they had kidnapped, girls they had kidnapped. They only brought in one. Her name was Matilda, and she had been tortured brutally. Her nose had been burned off. She'd been sexually assaulted. She had been traumatized terribly. So the discussions about peace did not get off to a good start, and it soon turned into a massacre in the council house. The Comanches were killed in shootouts and fights. And so the Comanches then regrouped. They killed a great many of the white Texans they were holding, killed them very brutally, staked them out and burned them. And then they mounted a huge raid from the Texas Hill Country all the way down to the Texas coast, which is several hundred miles. They raided, they rolled in unexpectedly and just wiped out everything in their path, and then turned around and went back to the Hill Country. The Rangers and others encountered them on their way, and there were some big battles. The Comanches were weakened even more at this time, but it was not a decisive battle. It was, you know, a running battle on horseback that covered miles and miles and miles. But it was one of those cases where, things started out small and peaceful and quickly escalated into terrible brutality and hundreds of people dying as a result of it.
We're talking with Doug Swanson about the true history of the Texas Rangers. Cult of Glory is the name of the book. We'll take a break and pick up the conversation in a moment.